probably the biggest compliment we have from that was, you know, one of the mothers who had brought her kids in during the holidays, who kind of went, you know, I was just amazed that here was this thing about zombies, and it wasn't overly about zombies, it was about medical science, and my two, you know, 10-year-old boys have spent the last 2 hours reading.
And that was Derek Williamson from the Museum of Human Disease. I mean, wow, what a way to start a STEM podcast when you're talking about zombies.
You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsom.
Yes, welcome again to another Physics Ed podcast. My name is Ben Newsom, and I'm so glad to bring a great friend of mine, Derek, onto this podcast because he runs one of the most wicked, most fascinating, most unreal museums you could possibly think of, the Museum of Human Disease. It is a UNSW museum in the heart of Eastern Sydney, and it's actually well known amongst, well, the STEM professionals, but I must say, it's not as well known as you might think. And actually, the Sydney Morning Herald only recently called it one of Sydney's treasures. The only thing is that people just have to discover it. So that's why I wanted to get Derek on, because he does an enormous amount of work in STEM, in teaching kids all about science, and specifically in his role, medical science. And that intro there about the zombies, well, we'll get onto that. It's a bit more than the average museum, but I tell you what, it is well worth your time and really bedded down in some hard science as well. Enjoy.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast.
G'day, Derek. Welcome to the Physics Ed Podcast.
Thanks, Ben. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, especially coming into a winter's morning. I mean, we're in the middle of winter's July holidays. Are very cold around this time, and it's really chilly.
It was icy this morning. Icy, yes.
It is, actually. Seeing we're chatting, obviously, on a STEM podcast. And by the way, people are listening. Like a number of guests, I've known Derek for quite a few years, but I know that there'll be people out there who haven't met Derek before. So, Derek, maybe describe what you do.
And the director of the Museum of Human Disease, which is a medical pathology collection at the University of New South Wales. It's part of the medicine faculty. And we try and get people to come in and learn about their health. So we have, as I said, a whole range of diseased human organs in bottles.
You've got one of the coolest names of a museum I've ever heard of. Anytime I ever mention someone, they go, hey, I know this bloke who works at the Museum of Human Disease. People go, what?
It is. I think if we were much bigger and it would be less impressive. I think the fact that we are quite obscure means that most people are unlikely to have heard of it, which kind of gives it that extra impetus and then the surprise nature of it. But pretty much we're not hiding anything, you know. It's like people know what they're getting to some extent when they come in. You know, it's hard to think that you're going to go to the Museum of Human Disease and not be confronted by something.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to the Museum of Human Disease and I thought I was going to learn about shipping or plants or something.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, let's actually address that, because I get that the obscurity is a niche area. But geez, when you do a niche area, you can do it really well because that's all you concentrate on. And my gosh, you do. And speaking of niche, the University of New South Wales is a big campus. It's a proper campus in Randwick and Sydney. So,
yes.
Do you find walking around campus that people know you exist there?
No. Most people, because it's quite a long campus, and there's and a big hill in the middle, and we're at the top of the hill. So anyone who studies a course that's at the bottom of the hill has very little need to come up to the top of the hill. And so there is a vast number of students who spend all their life at the bottom of the hill and don't see our signs or things like that. But there are a lot of people who do kind of enter through or past the museum, and kind of you'll talk to them. They go, oh, I've been here 10 years and I've walked past it every day for 10 years and I've always wanted to go in. You go,
I wonder what the barrier is. I mean, obviously at university they've got lectures to attend to, they've got, you know, research to be done and whatnot. I mean, if they pop their head in the door, what are they going to see?
Diseases of human beings. I think to some extent there is a, you know, when you give yourself that name, there is a percentage of the population who are going to go, that's not for me.
Yeah, get it.
You know, just that kind of immediate response to it. And I think the other thing is, you know, people who go to museums, it's a social occasion. And so sort of going, oh, I'm not sure my friends would want to come along. And then there, you know, it comes down to there are issues that these people who are coming to campus are coming here for a reason. And, you know, if it's coming for work, they turn up at work at the same time every day. And the idea of going out at lunch and going to the museum probably doesn't occur to them. And we try and do some things around that, but I guess we accept that there are issues with our location and our collection, and I think we're getting more well known. We've kind of focused a bit on trying to get into the minds of the residents of campus, so to speak, the kind of people that work here and the people who study here. But it's a slow burn, I think.
But what's cool about that collection? Like, I know you say you're in a small museum tucked away in the middle of the hill, but the collection's quite extensive. I mean, and the thing is, it's not just a museum, just a, hey, public, go check out the disease stuff. I mean, you're in the middle of a massive teaching area. I mean, you'd have students from all over the place who could benefit from what you've got.
Oh, absolutely. So we have, in our collection, we have about 3,000 bottles which are distributed between various teaching areas of campus and our clinical schools in rural areas. So we have about 1,800 here, and they represent the way most people will die in Australia this year. In terms of teaching, because classes on campus have become so enormous, the museum isn't a venue for classes anymore. Yeah. So the pots that we have, the bottles with these specimens in, go out to classes and are used in classes, tutorial classes and things like that. But probably the biggest move towards teaching was we got a grant through the NBN stuff 5 years ago or so, and our entire collection has been digitized and turned into a teaching repository that's available for, anyone in the world can access it now. It's part of a thing called the BEST Network, and SLICE is this image repository. So it has our specimens and X-rays and microscopy images and a whole range of different sorts of images in this collection called SLICE that medical educators and biomedical educators around the world take these images and put them into their online courses or their presentations and things like that.
Is that freely available, or people have to like pay a fee to be able to get in behind the scenes?
No, it's completely free to access to a limited extent. So you can go and browse it. So the network is called the BEST Network, Biomedical Education Skills and Training Network, which is best.net, I think, or org or edu. Anyway, if you Google BEST Network, and then within that there is a bunch of kind of digital teaching resources, which are predominantly being produced by tertiary educators. And some of those are freely available, and so a teacher could go and grab one of those and put it in their class and go through this tutorial. The BEST Network kind of allow a certain number of those freebies, but if an institute, you know, but if they see that this institution is kind of, you know, using these things every day for thousands of students, then they will approach them to purchase a license, which then gives them kind of a whole range of kind of extra benefits and stuff. But for SLICE, which is this image bank, anyone in the world can access SLICE and just go in and look at images. You can take a URL and you can put that in your computer wherever it is, and you can use that image in a presentation through that URL.
I was just thinking how great that would be. I mean, for obviously tertiary educators, yeah, they're going to love that. But I mean, this could go bring down a secondary into even primary areas so easily.
So there's a lot of kind of that that's there, and we are looking at how we can leverage off that availability to offer those sort of resources to schools. But it's one of those things where it's kind of, you know,
one people got to know about it in the first place.
And well, one more thing to do. So, you know, that that Slice repository is a great teaching resource for, you know, anyone who wants to teach biomedical human biology sort of topics, from anatomy to diseases to, you know, x-ray technologies or anything like that. So it's
stunning. No, it's brilliant. And so you've got this digital collection which people can access, albeit limited, but it's still got a lot of stuff in it. And then if you, you're a major institution using a lot, you've got a whole bunch of resources you can jump in as well. So the digital side's fantastic. And then you've got the physical specimens in your site. What are the ones that really grab people's attention? I mean, I know I've been in your site. There's, you know, there's a lot of bottles. There are a lot of specimens in there. What are the ones that really just, you just see the visitor just go, I've just got to look into this more. This is strange.
So there's probably three specimens that are in that really mysterious kind of category. So we have a polycystic kidney. Polycystic kidney is a genetic disorder that the cells in the tubules in the kidneys, some of the cells, a limited number of them, begin to reproduce out of control. And as they grow, they create a bubble, which then fills with fluid. So that's the cyst nature of it. And if lots of cells do it, you get lots of them, it's called polycystic. And as the cysts grow, they press up against the healthy kidney and they basically demolish the healthy kidney. And so we have this polycystic kidney, which would be about 45 centimeters long, would have weighed a couple of kilos. Put that in perspective, you know, the average human adult kidney is 13 centimeters long. So this is an enormous, enormous thing. And it's just this, and we've kind of sliced, butterflied it, to use a cooking term.
Because let's talk about cooking while we're talking about this. Why not?
And it's just full of these kind of great big bubbles, you know, and they are big. They're kind of the size of the big marble. What was it? The Tom Thumb marble or whatever it was. Big one. Tom Bowl or whatever it was. Anyway, that big marble, and even bigger, you know, maybe a small mandarin. Keeping on the topic of food. you can tell I haven't had morning tea yet. So that one, kind of simply for the enormity of it, is one of ours. And if people want to look at that, that's actually one of our volunteers just recently posted that on our Instagram. If you're a bit queasy, our Instagram account is probably not for you.
Maybe they're like a protected site. But it does have an image of our
polycystic kidney. The other one that kind of gets a lot of attention is a thing called a teratoma, which means monster growth. So this is teratomas occur in, they are basically a tumor of a sex cell. So not the egg or the sperm, but the support cells within the ovary or the testes. And because they are these germline cells that go on to produce eggs and things, they are effectively stem cells. And so as the tumor grows, it can differentiate into anything. So unlike a tumor that grows anywhere else in the body, so if you have a lung cancer, the cells of that will always be lung cells. Mm-hmm. Even if they metastasize and move somewhere else in the body, one of the ways we know where they came from is the fact that you look at them and go, that's a lung cell. What's it doing in your liver? But these ones, because they are stem cells and haven't had that kind of differentiation happen before they became tumorous, they can differentiate. And so within, we have a specimen which has a growth about 10 centimeters across, and in it there are brain cells and lung cells and skin cells and basically cells of every type of the body. But they're kind of really, the bit that strikes people the most is it has this long flowing red hair and a couple of teeth. Which is where these got their name originally, of teratoma, because they were the monster, basically this monstrous growth inside someone of
Frankenstein's monster style thing. Well, that's just wow. Mary Shelley would be she'd be in her element about here.
Well, I mean, you know, these are not horrendously uncommon. You know, it's one in 10,000 or so.
Right.
And women will have one. And so back in the day, before we had kind of medical care and scans and things where we might remove something at an early stage, this person would die from this growth. And if someone was looking inside, they'd go, my God, there's this thing with teeth and hair that obviously killed this person.
And that actually brings up the point. Like, I was just thinking about this going, so you've got visitors and you can have students and not always tertiary. They could be under 18. I mean, you've got that whole ethical side to discuss, don't you?
Yeah, it doesn't come up a lot. So we're happy to talk about it. It's not something we kind of shy away from.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there are sometimes students will go, you know, when we ask how do you think people react? Sometimes they'll bring up people might question why you have these things on display. And which is a great question. You know, we have this collection and it has been generously left to the university. And most other universities who have these collections, and most of the older universities in Australia will have one, they're behind closed doors, you know, so a school group might be able to arrange to go along, or they might do an open day occasionally, but generally they are reserved for medical and medical science students to kind of learn about these disease processes. So ours is the only one that opens every day and advertises and encourages schools to come in, because we think there are really important health messages that these students can learn from the specimens that we have.
In our respect to the donors as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like if this is here, we should be making the best use of it that we can, you know. Mm. So, and you know, we have a great response from schools, you know, in 20 odd years of doing this for schools, I don't think there's been a complaint, you know, in terms of how dare you show this to my child or
anything. Yeah, like, I mean, that. I suppose once you've got the parental permission slips and they know exactly what they're going to and critically why and where it fits within the curriculum, and that's actually, you guys have a very unique perspective in this, because I mean, a lot of museums would love to interact more with, I mean, I know I'm going down the high school track here a little bit, but often the high school curriculum, it's dense. It's got so much stuff going on that's hard enough to get any sort of field trip sorted out. And so you really want to be ticking off some serious syllabus dot points. And you guys have a very unique situation where senior sciences, the seniors about to head off to university, they're just in the very last part of high school, you really can help them out in their biology subjects.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, the area in the biology syllabus called Search for Better Health could almost have been written for us.
You reckon?
So, you know,
yeah.
Which is helpful. And you know, the previous people in my role have set it up with these great programs. You know, we have some great programs and we continue to modify them and tweak them as new information comes and things, but there's this great set of programs that just hit what is effectively a quarter of the Year 12 syllabus, and in 2 hours students can be exposed to nearly all of that quarter plus a few of the kind of other areas balance out really well.
But I must say, obviously, there's a student side, and that's really cool that you can hit the education thing on the element, but you guys do more than that. I mean, one of the things that grabbed my eye is some of the days that you do is almost like an open day, kind of involving zombies.
So the zombies program, it raised eyebrows here on campus when we said we were going to do it, but it's, I mean, you know,
I think it's fantastic. It was such a brilliant way to say, come to our museum, we're not a stuffy place.
Yeah. And you know, we did a lot of stuff in the traditional sense around that zombieism, but effectively that zombie experience that we ran was a station-based set of readings for students to do, you know, and our public audience. And probably the biggest compliment we have from that was, you know, one of the mothers who had brought her kids in during the holidays, who kind of went, you know, I was just amazed that here was this thing about zombies, and it wasn't overly about zombies, it was about medical science, and my two, you know, 10-year-old boys have spent the last 2 hours reading.
Right.
And so we try and create hooks, but we want them to be for a valid reason that is deeply embedded in the outcomes that we want to see for the audience that come to the museum anytime, which is really about addressing a range of various things around medical health, but it's really about people kind of going away with a better idea of how they can live a healthier, more relaxed life.
Well, that's right. And there'd be lots of listeners here who aren't just in the museum thing or teachers. There'd be parents, and they just want people to understand how the world works, and having literacies around this and anything that can grab them and hold their attention is a good thing.
Yeah.
Oregon's fantastic. I mean, you could certainly do some interesting stuff around augmented reality.
We are just getting into that. So we've just started a student project here, 3D imaging specimens. It's a small project at the moment, but the idea will be that we will 3D image a bundle of our specimens, and then we're putting in a virtual reality studio in the back of the museum where we will then look at how we interpret these sorts of things and how we can bring other virtual reality in from across the university and kind of add to it with augmented reality within the museum space.
That'd be fantastic. Actually, this is mine going off on a tangent, but I was looking up on YouTube various ways that people are teaching biology only a couple of days ago. And something I stumbled across was someone had actually created a model of the human heart using Minecraft.
Wow. Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant.
Absolutely. There's so much of that stuff that is, I think, going to become... it's going to become ubiquitous across teaching of kind of science and especially biology, you know, because as it becomes harder and harder to do a dissection in a school or some of those things, you know, and I think these give these opportunities with virtual and augmented reality and online things just give an opportunity to bring a realism to materials that, you know, your textbook and some of those things can't.
Absolutely. And speaking of dissections, I mean, you've been doing dissections for quite a few years via video conference, which is certainly a great way for people to interact with you if they can't get their hands on a specimen.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started that project a few years ago. So we do offer a range of different ones. So the one that we kind of like the most is the pluck dissection. So a pluck is when you get the lungs and liver and heart still connected from, and now just to be absolutely clear, these are abattoir sourced animal organs. So we can't do human dissections for people, just to clarify that. Mm. But this gives us, you know, the opportunity with the lungs. You can inflate the lungs, which is quite impressive when you see kind of the lungs inflating. And then, so we use the pluck to show this is what a healthy lung looks like, this is what a healthy heart looks like, this is what a healthy liver looks like, and then we bring in our diseased specimens and talk about what's different and why it's different. You know, what has changed in a liver with cirrhosis or hepatitis that makes it go from that beautiful dark red spongy-like thing to a gnarly yellow lump? You know, what is it about a heart valve that can break down? So they're illustrative, and I think that's kind of what's important, is to be able to link those two things together, because being a museum of human disease, often the one thing we don't have a lot of is healthy versions of the things that people are looking at. And it's a query we often get, and we're continually trying to address this idea of how do we show what it would have looked like if it was healthy, given that we can't display healthy versions, because there's a range of different collection practices around that.
No, it's awesome. And so, I mean, I'm just now thinking about, we've definitely got a very well-painted picture of what you guys do. And obviously, some really cool stuff coming up with this virtual reality and augmented reality. It's can't wait to see it, to be honest. Yep. But I'm just wondering, I mean, what got you into the museum trade, the museum business, the teaching of stuff? Where did this all come from?
Where did it come from? It's a good question. I studied zoology a long time ago, and I was quite passionate about it and kind of really enjoyed it. But I am not the sort of person that does a PhD in zoology. And I guess what I worked out over the course of studying zoology in a couple of years afterwards is that I much preferred to talk about what other people were doing than do the work myself. It's a bit flippant, but it was a balance between the kind of natures that I have, one of which is to be quite passionate about science and knowledge and the dissemination of understanding and things. And the other one was a bit of a theatrical bent to my nature. And so this kind of allowed kind of a, both of those things to happen.
I had a great chat with Karina Strecker, who is the distance learning person for Ann Arbor Hands-On Science Museum in Michigan. Yep. A good friend of mine a couple of years ago. And her background in theatre has done amazing. Yeah, you know, it's been really good for her. So my words are really stringing together very well. She actually came out with a Bachelor of Arts and doing theatre and all that type of stuff. And her trajectory into the Hands-On Science Museum was very interesting because she actually went and spent a couple of years working on an airline as an airline hostess. It's just interesting how people fall into the positions that they do.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a bit of a bent towards, I mean, especially in this, and they call this informal science education, but in a lot of ways it can be a little bit formal. But when we're out on stage or in front of a video conference camera or something, we've got to have some sort of spark
that
can hold people's attention.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, I used to love as a kid going to museums. I probably liked it a lot more then than I do now. I loved going to museums and I always thought, wow, how would I end up working in a museum? But there's not really a clear trajectory into a museum. And so I kind of forgot about it for a long time and just kind of, I had quite a checkered 20s of not really careers, lots of different sorts of jobs.
So you have a checkered past and now we're going to divulge it.
From picking fruit to a range of different things, you know, and eventually ended up going back and doing a teaching qualification for an adventure camping program that I was running just to kind of give a bit of credential to it.
That's really cool. I used to work as a water ski instructor and ran a waterfront camp in California a long time ago.
Oh, wow.
It was good fun, wasn't it? That type of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, they're great experiences, you know, and I think they offer this interaction with people that is just extraordinary, you know, and I think if we could get similar, and I guess that's what I've always aimed for with science education, communication, whatever you want to call it, museum stuff, is to try and provide that experience to people that you got in that kind of camping, outdoor ed kind of environment, which is, here is something that's quite challenging, here is something that is fun and something that's going to be worthwhile for you.
So I'm just actually wondering, so if you had someone fresh out of uni, they wanted to get into the museum trade, or not even just that. They could be a teacher who's been teaching for 10, 20 years or even 5 years, and they're going, you know what, I want to just try a little bit different. I want to teach in a different way. I mean, what would be your advice for them to sort of look towards this type of work?
I think with museums, that's a really hard question to answer because they're all different. And but I guess for me, it is to have a passion about a topic.
Yep.
You know, be really passionate about your topic, then creating some experiences that do that topic a bit differently than other people are doing it. I guess it's a bit like success in anything, is that you need to have a passion and a focus on the thing that you're interested in that you want to do, but then you need to do it in a slightly different way that puts you outside of the crowd. But also, you know, take opportunities that take you into that environment, you know. So, if you want to do out of classroom education, then as a teacher, get your class out of the classroom and do some things in school that you can then provide as kind of evidence for that ability to do that. You know, we have so many people who apply for jobs here when they come up, and they have a great classroom credential, but not much on top of that to show they do things a bit differently.
You know, yeah, well, Liam, so. It reminds me of a past episode we did with Karen Player from the Australian Museum, who started 20-odd years ago just volunteering on the floor of a museum.
Yeah.
And to this day, she's still with the same museum, but I suppose it's that start small and just build up the whole experience. It doesn't matter if you want to be a carpenter, you've got to start somewhere to learn how to chop wood. It's the same sort of thing, I suppose.
Yeah. And, you know, I tell my we have a lot of our students who are students from the university who volunteer in the museum, you know, and they'll kind of ask things about, you know, how do I get ahead in a career, you know, how do I, because they're looking at medical science or something like that, you know, and I think these days it's, if you're the sort of person that can do it, get yourself a YouTube channel.
You know, good point.
Because they're, you know, it's something that you can then, you know, once you get good at it, point to a couple of those to people who you want to get a job for and go with, and go, there's me doing this thing that you want done. You know, here I am talking to a group of people in a way that's articulate and clever and funny and whatever these things are, or here is me being deadly serious about whatever this is, or, you know, here's me doing this thing. So, you know, do that. Or a blog, if you're not confident in a camera, start with a blog and work on creating your brand, so to speak.
True. I mean, there are actually teachers especially that have created a phenomenal YouTube channel of just, here's a whole bunch of experiments we've been doing in my classroom. I just want to share stuff and go for it. Use it all you want.
Yep.
I've seen people sharing lots of information through Twitter or creating blogs and things. That's a great thing for the way to start. And to be honest, even if you never actually leave the teaching profession or wherever it is that you're doing, it's just good as an outlet to share and let people know what you know. It's a good thing.
Yeah. It, and as you say, even if you're not looking at kind of changing career as such, you know, but wanting to refresh your skill set and things, you know, that those are some of the ways that are relatively easy to do, you know, to do some of those things, and they're kind of inexpensive and they can become expensive, but, you know, and they might lead to a career change, but they might also just be great resources that you can share, that you can use in your classroom. So I think there is, especially for younger people, an almost imperative to be doing something other than the one thing you're really passionate about.
And definitely so. It's a creative outlet, absolutely. And look, in the spirit of sharing, have there been times where, like, you know, everyone loves to show the postcard, the picture-perfect way of our website, and everything's going really well. But in reality, when you're in front of kids all the time, or, you know, I'd love to know what's happening in tertiary level, there's been times when you've been running programs where you go, you know what, this just ain't working. I'm running this class and this lesson, we might as well stop and go out and have lunch. It's just gone bad. Have you ever had a situation where you're running a particular lesson, it's going bad? And I guess, and more importantly, were there ways that you were able to turn it around?
We have a lot of technology-based stuff, and quite often technology fails. So we went through a point where our AV setup would just pack it in every now and again. And so we had to kind of think on our feet. And in this environment, we're kind of lucky that we have specimens we can fall back on and a whole range of different kind of ways of doing things. So and it's very well rehearsed in some respects. So the times when stuff just doesn't work is when we're trying new things, when we go, oh, what people really would love to do is this online genetics thing, so let's get them doing that. And then you get halfway through it and people are glazing over and you're going, this was not quite the simple thing that we thought it was. let's go and look at some specimens.
Well, it's funny you talk about the technical aspect. I interviewed recently on one of the Physics Ed podcast webs episodes, Jan Zanitas from CILC, the Center for Interactive Learning and Collaboration. And I distinctly remember being at a conference with her and a whole bunch of distance learning professionals. Like, we're talking like 20 of us or something in this room in Philadelphia. So there's one moment in time we had a lot of knowledge from people from all over the globe on how to make video conferencing work. None of us could get through the firewall. None of us could get the thing to connect, even to the data projector. This museum that we're working at was just completely locked down. And it was just, we had this bemusement where I was going, surely the brain's trust is actually in the room right now, and no one knew how to make it work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually remember having to present because we couldn't even get the thing to talk to, even just get the data projector to work properly. It was just some crazy setup. I actually had, there's a photo of me presenting to this group of esteemed museum types, holding a laptop in my arm and walking it around.
So people can see your slide.
Yeah. It's going, here, really, we are technical. We really, really are.
Yeah.
And you get through it. And I think people who have been around a while with technology, I think everyone just goes, yep, been there. You've done it.
Well, you know, I think there's a, with tech, you know, any technology, you know, I look at a lot of presentations, you know, and I started back in the days of Gestetners and overhead projectors and, you know, and I think I still see slides where I go, all that person has done is taken their overhead projector thing and put it onto a PowerPoint. And that if you're going to be good at presenting with slides, you should be able to do it without them.
I agree. No,
that slides are, for me, slides are a replacement for palm cards in lots of respects.
You know? Especially when people read off it. And if I've been sat there in a conference and they're talking about innovative teaching, reading the information off the slide itself, yeah, and going, wow, I suppose it's good.
19 dot points on the slide.
Right, in point eight form.
Yeah, so it all fit. And probably our worst thing is less about technology, because those are things that you can kind of get around a little bit more easily. With we were running a HSC revision day here for year 12 students, and the kind of week before, the facilities management people came and they were going to drill a hole through the floor above us, theatre. They were going to do it in the middle of the night so I wouldn't interact and there'd be no thing. And I foolishly said, look, you know, I realise you'll clean up and stuff. I just don't want to come in and find that you've flooded the place. So I rock up at 8 o'clock the next morning and they had got the apprentice to drill the hole through the concrete, but no one had told the apprentice that about 2.5 centimetres below the concrete was a high pressure water main. And so when they drilled through and the drill broke through and kind of dropped down straight into this high pressure water. So I came into our theatre flooded, all of the electricity turned off, and the flood continuing under the floor into the museum space, and had half an hour before we had this group of 50 HSC students turning up to be revised. So that was probably one of the more recent.
Imagine five. The please explain. Sir, it happened again.
Yeah.
Oh no.
So that was but you know, fortunately I'm on a big campus, you know, so it's not hard to find a new room and people are going to come and clean it up and things. So
good news, you've got boxes and you, most of your specimens are from a human body. Well, they are. So that means they're going to be transportable in some way.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a floor thing. And so it was in lots of respects, not the drama, but it certainly kind of, you know, sets up one of those feelings of, oh my God, where do we go? And then you've got to sit and sort it out. So that was,
I've been speaking with so many people, not just on the podcast, but years. I've never heard of such a problem happen. No, I guess it's going to happen eventually. Math says so.
Well, yes. It's at some point, someone about to present to someone is going to have a water main burst on them.
Wow. At least they weren't doing it at the time.
Well, yeah. at least they did it in the middle of the night and not, didn't.
Oh. That's awesome. Look, Derek, thank you so much for popping on our podcast. Really appreciate your time. I know you got a busy schedule, definitely so. But undoubtedly, there'll be people who would love to get in touch with you. Yep. And how might they do that?
So I am Derek, D-E-R-E-K .Williamson@unsw.edu.au on Twitter and Instagram. And we are the museum is Disease Museum, one word, @unsw.edu.au. So either of those email addresses, or follow us on Twitter and Instagram and stuff.
Yeah, and go get grossed out on Instagram, isn't it?
And come and visit. Yeah. We're on the University of New South Wales campus in Randwick in Sydney.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll certainly throw that all in the show notes and also links to be able to actually get some of those free resources that are in the digital aspect, because I really think that there'd be schools and tertiary places that could really get a lot out of that. And even just for pure curiosity.
It's well worth looking at, especially, you know, Slice. Going and having a look on Slice is kind of quite eye-opening.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, thanks very much, mate. Go enjoy what winter sun we have left.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks, appreciated. Ben. Take it easy.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're all about science, ed tech, and more. To see 100 fun free experiments you can do with your class, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled FIZZICS. And click 100 free experiments.
And there you go. I told you that was going to be a fascinating interview. At least I certainly found it interesting chatting with Derek. I mean, I've known Derek for years, but actually getting him to talk about exactly what goes on in that place is really an eye-opener about what is hidden around our cities. And I must encourage you, go check out what's around your cities. You might find that there's going to be some hidden gems of, you know, learning and science and stuff, which just doesn't get the full mainstream media attention that, to be honest, should be well-deserved. And how awesome is it that you can have, like, you know, literally 3,000 bottles of diseased specimens, you know, available for use for students to learn about how the body works and when it goes bad? That is wicked. I really do. I really love that. So, look, here are my three takeaways I definitely grabbed from this interview, and I'd love to know what you'd think too, by the way. But firstly, my one is definitely use unusual objects. You know, look, weird objects, strange objects are going to raise students' questions and promote their interest in science in general. So even if you don't have a wicked collection like, well, what Derek has, I mean, of course, I mean, not often you're going to have a Museum of Human Disease just at your disposal. Having something interesting that is unusual for kids to go, whoa, what's that thing, is really, really handy. I mean, even if it means just putting it at your front bench and just not saying anything and letting kids try and work out what the thing is about will grab their attention, I guarantee it. So, use unusual objects. And, hey, if you can engage with Derek and his team, you know, be my guest, totally, it's going to be worth your time. Number two, experiment with technology. Now, the Museum of Human Disease does a lot of this. They've done video conferencing, they're playing around with augmented reality and virtual reality. And how good is it that Slice, the image repository of x-rays, images and microscopy images and all this other stuff that universities and, to be honest, the public by the sound of it, and very much so, I've gone on there, I've gone and checked it out, you really can just jump on in and have a look at these, you know, world-class images to teach yourself about how the human body works. I mean, how good is that? So, yeah, like Derek mentioned, jump onto the BEST website. That's the Biomedical Education Skills and Training Network. Well, a bit of a mouthful there. So the Biomedical Education Skills and Training Network. So, you know, just jump onto best.edu.au and you can certainly, you know, definitely, you know, learn a heap of that. And, hey, if you're an educational institution and you're finding you're using it a lot, you know, pay it forward. See if you can contact with them and see if you can maybe organize some sort of ongoing, you know, small stipend to be able to help support that museum, and, you know, well worth it. Number three for me is use a hook. Use a hook to grab kids' attention. Now, I know certainly an unusual object that I mentioned at the start will grab kids' attention, but I tell you what, when Derek put forward the zombie day for the holiday programs during the, you know, the Sydney vacation break, that really grabbed people's imaginations. And like the mum said, you know, the one that Derek was talking about, like the mum said, her two boys, her two 10-year-old boys, were engrossed in reading after the fact. Yes, they came in for a zombie day, and now they're learning about medical science. And you know what? That is just brilliant.
Thanks for listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. Love your science? We do too. Here's this episode's Education Tip of the Week. Grab your pencil and get ready to make some notes.
Yeah, it's time for another Ed Tip of the Week, which will help make your classroom shine and be really vibrant and, you know, the sort of place that students want to hang around with. And in this case, I'd like you to consider maybe trying out having your kids run a pitch fest. Now, what do I mean by that? A pitch fest generally is like the Dragon's Den or Shark Tank. You know, those shows where entrepreneurs pitch what they do to people who might invest in their idea, concept, and business. This really has grabbed, you know, the world's attention, especially these days in mainstream media. But I must say, it also has grabbed kids' attention. You know, they look up to startups and entrepreneurs and people who have founded and creating stuff that will do good in the world. So rather than creating science or technology, engineering or maths, you know, doing those classes in like a bubble, why not get kids to really understand that STEM doesn't exist in a vacuum? It needs to be used. It's valued in the world. And nothing says that more than having kids, well, pitch their concept, come up with their idea. And so in this case, I'm going to go through a number of steps that really could be worthwhile considering if you want to go down a lesson like a pitch fest. So here you go. First up, if you're going to do this, you need to share the marketing rubric first and make sure kids actually know what you're trying to do. Maybe even show them like a short excerpt from Dragon's Den or Shark Tech just to get, just get their heads in gear before they start to sort stuff out. But the critical reason for setting up a marketing rubric is that this will stop you from being too subjective. I mean, it's pretty hard when, kids are trying to pitch different ideas. If you haven't got something that they're trying to shoot for and you're trying to mark against, it's going to be really hard to grade who does better and all the rest. And also, it'll help kids understand that when they're creating something, they've got to create it for the end user. In this case, you're the end user. You're the one with the marketing rubric. Try and lean points towards STEM concepts that are raised within the design but still have room for creativity. Also, within that marketing rubric, try and make sure there's a bit of a grading towards, their ability to persuade the audience on their idea. I mean, it's all about speaking skills in the end when it comes to pitching a concept. Secondly, ensure that they know that it's fun. They're not really competing to launch a product. Kids can take things to heart a little bit too much, and if they make it all too serious, they may well freak out or crumble up on the front stage as other kids watch. Make it fun, make it easy. They're winning a chocolate bar or something. Make it fun. It doesn't necessarily have to be a formal marking thing. It's just something kind of good. Hey, also, consider a balanced judging process. What I mean by that is not just yourself marking it, why don't you have a student panel? I mean, you could hold a lottery as to who gets to be on the judging panel. Maybe you need to rotate it, and to be honest, it's probably quite fair to rotate it. Give them all a marking rubric that they have to adhere to, and hopefully they help create this way that students hear from their own peers what they like and what they don't like, and that'll help them grow as much as possible. Just for your classroom management, just be aware of classroom cliques. You want to get rid of those as much as possible. If the judging panel is a little bit too upfront, might be a bit uncomfortable with your particular group of students, maybe consider doing polling. There's a great program called Poll Everywhere. There's a free service and a paid service where kids could use their own devices, jump on the computer or whatever. Just put in their own grades without, letting everyone know. It could be just simply anonymous, and you can see what the classroom's thinking, what the audience is thinking in real time. You could even have that happening behind them if you so feel. Look, it doesn't have to be modeled on Shark Tank or Dragon's Den. It's just going to be something that could be just fun that kids can do. It'd be ideal if they create a working model of their idea, not just a blueprint, not just a PowerPoint, something that actually does stuff. And obviously, you'll need to give them some time so they can create it. And if you can, of course, embed it in the curriculum that you're currently studying. So there you go. Maybe try out a pitch fest. It might be worth your time.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're excited about science. Grab a copy of our new book, Be Amazing, How to Teach Science the Way Primary Kids Love, from our website. Just search Be Amazing Book. It's available in hard copy and ebook. Go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled FIZZICS.
Yes, and while the Museum of Human Disease is very much tucked away in the heart of UNSW and often students walk past it, there are still well-known places, very well-known places, where people don't realise what also goes on in them. And one of these places is the Royal Botanic Garden in Sydney. And our last week's guest, Mary Bell, went into some of the things that goes on in a garden like hers.
Here at the Botanic Gardens, where we celebrated our 201st birthday this year, as a botanic garden, that is, of course. We have a deep history, we have Aboriginal culture, special sites here. We have the site of the first farm, so there's great history. But we can bring language into our programs and use the gardens as a backdrop to tell stories like Alexander's Outing, which is the book written about a duck that lives here. Or we can do mathematics programs, or traditional science and life cycles. The world's your oyster. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you'd think a Royal Botanic Garden would only do workshops on plants and plant dissections and flowers and all that type of botanical stuff. And yet there's a lot more going on than people often realise. So look, I encourage you to jump on our last week's podcast. It's certainly worth the effort.
Thanks for listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. Sign up now for our fortnightly email newsletter. It's loaded with details on new experiments you can do, STEM teaching articles, new gadgets, exclusive offers, and upcoming events. Go to physicseducation.com.au. Scroll to the bottom and add your email.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of the Physics Ed Podcast. Hey, check next week ones out. It's a little bit different. We'll be coming to you from the Innovation Games. Now, the Innovation Games is brand new. It's a major festival which has been put together by Sydney Olympic Park as part of the Sydney Science Festival. It's supported by Inspiring Australia and National Science Week. And we've got heaps of things going on, from geology to road safety science, through to drones and you name it. There's all sorts of stuff when it comes to science, tech, engineering and maths. And look, I'll be down there interviewing a number of good friends down there who are going to be putting on public exhibitions for people on their way to a rugby league match. So look, it'll be a little bit boisterous, a little bit loud, but it should be a lot of fun. Look, as always, may your science lessons be fun, and please make them informative as possible, and please grab your students' imagination. You've been listening to me, Ben Newsome from Physics Education, and of course you've been listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. All the best, catch you next time.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed Podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book and more, go to physicseducation.com.au.